Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm interested in emerging infectious diseases, and there have been a lot of diseases that have caught a lot of attention lately, things like SARS and West Nile and, of course, H1N1. And to really understand the risk to humans of these diseases, you need to understand both the processes of pathogenesis within an individual and also the transmission between individuals. And what's going on at the individual level is going to influence the infectivity of individuals and thereby influencing transmission. And so really to understand these diseases, you need to understand things at a range of different levels of biological complexity. So one thing about emerging infectious diseases of humans compared to wildlife is that in most cases, diseases in human populations haven't led to big crashes in human populations. We don't see extinctions yet of populations of humans due to diseases. In the Middle Ages, plague is one of the best examples of a disease sweeping through and causing massive human mortality. And HIV/AIDS in Africa at this point could be suppressing the population growth there. But there's actually lots and lots of examples recently of emerging infectious diseases coming in and causing huge impacts on wildlife populations. So for example, there's a recent new disease sweeping through bats in the eastern part of the United States, leading to extinctions of populations. There's a really horrible transmissible cancer that is causing this facial tumor disease in Tasmanian devils. Yes, Tasmanian devils actually are a real thing. And it's leading to extinctions of populations of Tasmanian devil. Plus, there's lots of diseases of marine mammals, corals, and I wanted to mention one plant disease, sudden oak death, that's causing oak mortality in parts of California because other people in my lab are working on that. And the disease that I'm going to concentrate on today is chytridiomycosis in amphibians. And this is a pretty fascinating disease of amphibians. It's something that just recently popped up or recently was noticed in amphibians around the world about a decade ago. It was simultaneously noticed in Australia and Central America. And the causal agent for it, this chytrid fungus, Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, was only first described in 1999. And it was described as a new genus and species. And it's got a long name, and so people tend to just call it BD. And we're studying this disease in a particular frog species, Rana muscosa, that occurs only in the Sierra Nevada mountains of California. And a fungal disease, which it turned out to be this, was first noticed in populations of Rana muscosa about a decade ago. And there are a few interesting features of this particular frog that make it very susceptible to this aquatic pathogen. It has a very long-lived tadpole stage, so these individuals can spend 1 to 4 years as tadpoles. They actually overwinter under the ice up in the Sierras for several years before becoming subadults and then adults. And all of the stages of this frog are highly aquatic, putting them in continuous contact with the pathogen, which is transmitted by this motile zoospore stage. It's a species of fungus that has a flagellated zoospore that is thought to persist in the water for less than a day, although there's some evidence of longer-term survival. And the zoospores, they insist on the skin of the frogs, and within a couple of days start releasing zoospores from the sporangia on the frog. And so all we know about this fungus so far is this very simple asexual life cycle. Other species of chytrids have a sexual stage and have a resistant sporangia stage that can persist outside the host longer, but we haven't found it yet in this particular disease. And the symptoms of chytrid depend on the stage of the frog because BD targets keratin. And tadpoles have keratin only in their mouth parts, whereas adults and subadults have keratin throughout their skin. And so there's really little effect on the tadpoles. Although tadpoles can become infected and transmit the disease, they don't die from the disease. But individuals, after metamorphosis, can suffer thickening and shedding of skin, and in many cases, death of the organism. And this is in the news right now because in this week's Science, there's an article by Jamie Voiles et al. That shows that BD is killing frogs through interfering with the transport of electrolytes across the skin. So what we're seeing in the Sierra Nevada is different outcomes of this pathogen in different areas. What we're seeing right now going on in the southern parts of the Sierra, California, Rana muscosa occurs, or at least used to occur, in all of the green area. And in areas of Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park in the southern Sierra, right now we're seeing the fungus getting there for the first time, causing huge population declines, local extinctions of hundreds of frogs from hundreds of water bodies. Whereas in other parts of the Sierra, especially around Yosemite National Park, what we're seeing is apparent persistence of the frogs with the fungus. And so what I've been doing and what I'm going to try to do in this talk is to use the dynamical models to first understand what types of factors lead to these different outcomes of this pathogen, and then to develop strategies to control these outbreaks. So this is just to give you an idea of what's going on in the southern parts of the Sierra. This is a map of Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. Each of these green, the blue stuff on here is water. So it's the streams, the lakes, the rivers, and so on in the park. And historically, frogs occurred throughout the entire park. Every water body pretty much had Rana muscosa. And as of 1997, the frogs had already disappeared from the western part of the Sierras. And that was partially probably due to chytrid before we knew that it even existed. But it was also due to introduced fish, which is a whole different story. And all of the green dots here are where Rana muscosa were present in 1997. And since then, this fungus has been sort of sweeping across the Sierras from west to east, leading to extinction after extinction of populations of Rana muscosa. So that at this point, each of the marks on here is one of the same populations that I showed you before. And this is the status as of 2006. I really need to update this picture. But as of a couple of years ago, all of these little crosses on here were where populations of frogs have already gone extinct due to this fungus. And at this point, the wave of chytrid has swept even further, and there's only very few small areas of the park where the fungus hasn't gotten there yet. Things are different in Yosemite National Park to the north, where we missed the initial epidemic of BD. By the time we started surveying it in the mid-1990s, there were actually very few populations of frogs left, these sort of scattered small populations around the park. But almost all of these remaining populations are small, and almost all of them are infected with the fungus, but almost all of them have been persisting for many years in this infected state. And so we're trying to figure out what's going on. One thing that we've done is we've done mark recapture studies where we go out and tag individual frogs and with a little pit tag, same thing you use on your dogs to identify them with unique numbers. And we can swab them, run real-time PCR to tell whether the frog is infected or not, and also to quantify how infected it is, release the frogs. And we've done this over 6 years now. And you can put the data into a multi-state mark recapture model to come up with parameters for survival probabilities, state transitions, and recapture probabilities. And one of the interesting things from this is that at this point, there's no detectable effect of BD infection on adult survival at these persistent sites, even though the BD is killing frogs by the hundreds and thousands in other parts of the Sierras. So what's going on? At these persistent sites, it turns out that the adults are infected with only very low levels of infection, as what we're calling low fungal load, as measured by the real-time PCR. And the graph on the right shows the fungal load through time at one of the sites. The key to these two graphs is up here. And basically, the light colors are sort of greenish colors are uninfected. The light colors are very, very low levels of infection. And as we get to the red ones, we're getting relatively high infections. And these loads are really quite low compared to what we're seeing during die-offs. At these sites, the adults are frequently losing and regaining the infection. This is showing a graph through time of fungal load on individuals that we've been capturing, these same individuals over 6 years now. And individuals are sort of, their load is fluctuating around at relatively low levels, going to uninfected levels and back in. Whereas at these same sites, the tadpoles actually have very high fungal loads. This is comparing the different life stages, and the tadpoles and the recently metamorphosed individuals have relatively high fungal loads. Whereas at sites where the frogs are dying due to chytrid, what we're seeing is that the fungal loads are rapidly reaching incredibly high levels. These are data from six or seven populations sort of lined up at the point where the population first started to decline. At that point, the fungal load on individuals was reaching loads in the area of 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 zoospores per individual. And at these loads, these high fungal loads, the adults rapidly die of chytridiomycosis, and the tadpoles then die as each cohort of tadpoles goes through metamorphosis. And so what I'm going to be doing, or what I've been doing, is to use dynamical models to try to understand the factors that are leading to these different outcomes, the survival of individuals or death, the persistence of population or extinction, and then to develop strategies to control the outbreaks. And there's actually quite a long history of using models to understand epidemics, to understand disease transmission and spread through populations. And sort of the classic approach is the SIR framework, where individuals are divided just into classes based on disease status. So you have susceptible, infected, recovered, and there are transitions between the classes that represent things like transmission, recovery, and so on. But this framework seems to do a really poor job of capturing what's going on in the BD system, because it appears that the within-host dynamics and the dynamics of the fungal load on individuals appears to be very important. And in particular, it appears that for this pathogen, individuals don't just have to get infected once in order for the disease to progress. They have to get repeatedly reinfected. And that's very different from like when you get the flu. You get the flu once, you sort of have a set progression of symptoms, and you don't have to, or actually being re-exposed to other individuals that have the flu won't affect the progression of the disease in you, usually. Whereas in BD, this fungus appears to lack really an effective mechanism to spread between cells of an individual. And all of the transmission actually happens through the water. This is a close-up of frog skin showing these discharge papilla. And this is a microscope picture of sporangia releasing these discharge with a discharge papilla, releasing the zoospores out into the water. And so individuals have to be continually reinfected in order for the disease to progress from something that's just a low level of infection to something that reaches loads that can kill the frog. And so we developed a series of models. This is a very simple one that describes the BD load dynamics, starting out with just a single frog in some body of water. And it follows the number of sporangia on an individual frog and the number of zoospores in the pool, and includes such processes as the transmission encounter between zoospores and frogs, the release of zoospores. Some fraction of the zoospores might immediately reinfect the same individual, whereas the other fraction might enter the pool. And there's also loss rates of sporangia and zoospores. And what we assume in the model, which seems to be consistent with what we see in lab experiments, is that the frogs can tolerate only some maximum level of zoospores before they die. And we assume that above this threshold, the frog dies. And so this simple model with a single frog is just a set of linear equations. Here I've shown the deterministic version of it. Stochasticity is obviously very important in this system, and so we've done stochastic versions of it as well. And it's a set of linear equations, so there's really only two outcomes that can occur on a single frog. Either the number of sporangia will go to zero, and the frog will lose the infection, or it'll grow exponentially, reach S max, and the frog will die. And which of these outcomes will occur depends on the conditions. This is showing for a couple of the different parameters that you can have BD growth rates on individual frogs either growing exponentially or declining. And some of these parameters, such as the reinfection rate, are going to depend on what type of environment the frogs are in. So, for example, in fast-moving water, it's likely that more of the zoospores will be swept away from an individual, whereas in stagnant pools, more of them are likely to reinfect the same individual. Other parameters are features of the species of frog. So, for example, the fraction of the zoospores that, when encountering a frog, are able to successfully insist. Frogs, of course, ooze all sorts of stuff out of their back, and a lot of those things are antimicrobial compounds, and they can kill off the zoospores that try to insist. And some species have better abilities to do that than others. So you can then take the same model and instead of just following a single frog, put a number of frogs in a pool. And what this model with multiple frogs shows is that as you increase the number of frogs, the BD growth rate increases, and also the time that it takes for each individual frog to reach the level of zoospores at which they die decreases. This is showing number of frogs, BD growth rate, and I've chosen a set of parameters where on a single frog, the BD growth rate is negative. Above some threshold numbers of frogs in the population, it goes positive, and the fungus can grow. And above that threshold, the days to reach the maximum number of zoospores decreases. So at high densities of frogs, individuals are going to die faster of this disease. So in large frog populations, what you see is rapid buildup of the zoospore pool in the number of zoospores in the population and the population of frogs crashing. And so each of these are the density of sporangia on individual frogs, each starting out with one individual that was infected, and he managed to spread it to other individuals. That individual dies, and each individual dies as it reaches some S-max. So this type of mortality due to the fungus can lead to a type of feedback, whereas as you have lots of mortality, it suppresses the population, drives it down to a level where the BD growth rate on individual frogs might be negative. But in actuality, that's happening so fast, this mortality of the frogs in large populations is happening so fast that the frogs die before this effect kicks in. And so to study this further, we need to add something about the demography of the frogs, the birth and death rates of the frogs not due to chytrid. And we've tried a number of different versions of this. In the simplest version, we've followed a population that is unstructured. We don't include the fact that frogs really have a tadpole stage and an adult stage. We just assume that all individuals are equally susceptible. And we assume that throughout most of the season, all that's going on is disease transmission, death of individuals due to disease. And then at the end of each year, or actually each spring, the frogs reproduce. They produce some number of offspring, and it proceeds from year to year. For this type of unstructured frog population, for most parameter combinations, what you're going to get is either BD rapidly driving the frogs extinct or BD failing to invade and it itself going extinct. I'm going to show a couple of graphs like this where for different combinations of parameters, this is showing the fraction of a bunch of stochastic runs for which BD and frogs are able to persist. And the red regions are where they are persisting and the blue regions is where they're not. This is showing the fungal load on individual frogs within a season. And so this is the sporangia on individual frogs. So within a season, in the persistent region, most of the individuals are having exponential growth of the fungus to a point where that's killing the frogs. But some individuals with low load are managing to sort of make it through the season to the point where there's an influx of new individuals allowing the birth of new susceptible individuals to sort of offset the mortality due to the disease. So persistence in this way is really kind of a fragile thing. We investigated a number of other factors, such as an external source of zoospores. And an external source of zoospores makes persistence much more likely. And this external source could be from an alternative host of some sort out there, either other frogs or other abiotic things that this fungus might be able to persist on, or BD survival in the environment. And in this way, So when you have an external source of zoospores, it's possible to get persistence for a huge range of parameters with low transmission rates. And in this, when things are persisting in this way, what's really happening is that individuals are continually getting reinfected from the environment, and the load on individuals without that that influx of zoospores would be declining. Also, having a tadpole stage, like the Rana Muscosa tadpole stage, where tadpoles can get infected and spread it to other individuals, also helps with persistence of the pathogen. And it does that because the tadpoles are sort of acting as a within-host reservoir. We've also included models, done various versions of the models, with the full Rana Muscosa age structure. That includes having the long-lived tadpoles, the subadult stages, and so on. And the sort of general result from these models with the frog population dynamics in there is that if the frogs can make it through the initial arrival of BD and initial huge reduction in population size, then there's a chance for the system to enter a new endemic phase where the densities are much lower and the individuals are being infected with only low loads and being able to persist. And so it appears that in order for populations to make it and get to this new endemic state, the crucial point is making it through the crash. So, and I believe that that what's actually going on in parts of the Sierras is that we're seeing the first arrival of BD to the areas, the population crashes, and in a lot of cases, everybody dies, they go extinct. But in those few cases where a few individuals are able to make it through that initial crash, it is possible for the frogs to persist with the fungus and persist in a way where there's just low fungal loads. And so I wanted to investigate the possibilities for control of BD outbreaks. So first, you probably noticed that I didn't include anything about the adaptive immune response in the model. And I did that because it hasn't proven to be very effective against BD. BD is just an infection of the skin. It really seems to be just sort of mechanically interfering with transport across the skin. And one of my grad students did a bunch of experiments trying to immunize frogs, either with killed chytrid, with adjuvant, with all sorts of things, to try to stimulate the immune response against BD, and they all proved to be a failure. And so we're not going to come up with a frog vaccine against BD. However, there are a number of antifungal compounds that we can use to clear individuals of the fungus. It is possible to treat individuals. However, given the widespread distribution of BD at this point, people are finding it all over the world, it seems like it's unlikely that we're going to be able to totally eliminate BD from populations. And so maybe our best bet for persistence of some of these threatened populations is with BD present, with BD persisting in an endemic state. And so maybe our target for control should be helping the populations through this initial outbreak. And so we can use models to ask what is the best strategy for this. And we've tried a number of different strategies. I'm rapidly running out of time. But we tried, we have really kind of pretty blunt tools to fight off this pathogen. We can go in there and at crucial points in time remove adults or remove tadpoles to try to drive down the density of the density of the populations, because larger populations crash harder. Or we can treat individuals with antifungal agents. We can treat adults or tadpoles. And for any of these types of treatments, we can also investigate what's the best timing to do this. Should we be doing this when the fungus first arrives? Is there any point in doing it after most of the individuals have crashed and there's only the few individuals remaining? If we save those few individuals, will they be able to persist? And we can also vary the fraction that we treat. And so far, among all of these strategies, it appears that treating the tadpoles with antifungal agents, especially at the point where the adults have already crashed in the population, we just have tadpoles left that, without any intervention, those individuals would as they go through metamorphosis, die due to the fungus. So treating the tadpoles appears to be effective. And this is just showing a few not very clean simulations of... this is just showing through time adults and tadpoles, zoospore density. A population that is uninfected, BD invades at year 9, it looks like, and we can go from a situation by treating tadpoles during this sort of crucial stage in here, from a case where there's rapid extinction, to persistence at a new endemic state, or in some cases, recovery, if we manage to drive it out. But in cases of recovery, there's always the potential for BD to reinvade. So this isn't just a sort of hypothetical academic thing. We're actually trying some of these treatments out. And this complicated picture is really just a bunch of maps of three basins, Milestone Basin, 60 Lake Basin, and Barrett Lake Basin, showing through time the progression of the disease. And the green lakes are lakes that were initially uninfected. When they're yellow, they become infected and have BD. And when they turn black, that's when the frogs are extinct. And so over and over again at these basins, and sort of the, if you can see the cloud of gray on them, those are the places where BD has gotten to so far. In each of these cases, it's sort of spreading from a single point in the basin outward. And we've been watching this happen, and we decided in 2006 that we had to do something about it. And at that point, we were able to treat just a couple of small populations in 60 Lake Basin. And it turns out that those are some of the few populations that are still alive today. And this past summer, we've gone in and treated six other populations across a couple of basins to see if we can protect some of these populations. So in conclusion, in the Sierra Nevada, we're currently seeing both the epidemic and endemic phases of BD. And understanding the persistence versus extinction requires a model that includes the fungal load dynamics. And we can potentially use this model to design strategies to control these outbreaks. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
About these frogs that are resistant, you think it's that they're really mutant, or is it just that the population of chytrid fungi is low enough where it never really gets to go to high enough level to really infect enough?
Yeah, so we actually know a lot about the genetics of the frogs, and we're getting increasing knowledge. I mean, the genome of the fungus has been sequenced now, and it turns out the fungus has very little genetic variation worldwide. It's really kind of fascinating. But for the frogs, we do have a nice phylogeny of the frogs across the Sierras. And there isn't really a nice clean break between the frogs across the Sierras do break into two clades, but there isn't a nice clean break between die-off and persistence versus northern versus southern frogs. And we've done experiments looking at differences in susceptibility of frogs to see if the frogs from the different populations have differential susceptibility. We haven't actually been able to detect that. We have, however, been able to detect some differences in virulence of the fungus in different areas, even though there is pretty low variation. Mm-hmm. But that's a sort of developing story.
So it's probably a dynamic between the genetics of the frog and maybe a little change in the fungus and its a relationship that is complex.
And my sort of null hypothesis isn't really null, is that it could just be population dynamics. It could just be that following the crash, you'd have these new lower population sizes where the loads are just sort of putzing along at low densities because of not very efficient transmission.
Mm-hmm. What is the treatment involved? Is it treating the water?
It's actually soaking individuals. So it's not something that you can go do worldwide. The treatments that we did in 2006, it was just with malachite green. Malachite green can, what people use on their aquaria all the time, can cure frogs.
So you pull them out?
It involves going to lakes, collecting all the frogs that we can, soaking them for 5 minutes a day and putting them back and holding them temporarily. And this past year we used itraconazole, which is another antifungal agent.
But that's clear from the lake?
Our hope is that by clearing the individuals, clearing a large fraction of the individuals will suppress the density of zoospores in the lake to a low enough level. We haven't, especially in national parks, been able to go in and spray any compound into the water. They just won't let us do that.
my background is working broadly on complex systems, robustness trade-offs, and just recently, one of my graduate students completed his PhD, Sean Stromberg, and his thesis has been on looking at robustness trade-offs and trade-offs between robustness and vulnerability that come about through natural adaptive mechanisms in the immune system. So here's Sean, and this work was supported by the ICB, and it fits within a broader framework of work that has been going on in my group and also John Doyle here from Caltech that falls under a sort of general acronym of something we call highly optimized tolerance, which is a mechanism for complexity that seems to capture a lot of features of complex systems in biology and ecology and technological systems. And so part of the work we've been doing is looking at simple models for trade-offs, and then others has branched out over the last 10 years into a wide range of application areas. And so the basic idea of this mechanism is, quite different from some of the complex systems mechanisms that have been popularized, by physicists, most physicists. In this particular case, it's a kind of blend of ideas that come from biology, engineering design, and uses the language of physics and simple models in order to illustrate these phenomena. And the idea is that instead of being something like a phase transition or a critical point, instead we look at the process of design and evolution to high-performance states. These high-performance states are embedded in a complex, highly variable environment, and that tolerance to the environmental uncertainty leads to a wide range of different mechanisms for complexity, which will make a system robust on average, but can also lead to vulnerabilities. So the evolution in a complex environment leads to specialized, hierarchical, modular structures, often hidden complexities, and it's the vulnerabilities, the flip side of those complexity mechanisms that we'll call fragilities here. So robust yet fragile behavior is something, in the complex systems today, in our technologies, in diseases, in ecosystems that are important to understand. Okay, so again, this idea of robust yet fragile is an important one and the central idea to this mechanism for complexity. The idea is your system is robust to uncertainties that are common, the system is designed to handle or has evolved to handle, and fragile to unknown or rare events or events that haven't been part of the evolutionary history. So this is really the central idea that underlies our approach to complex system and is also what I'm going to be talking about today in the context of the immune system. So another application area in my group is wildfires, very important in California. And one of the things about this particular slide is that really, when you look at ecosystems, lightning, sparks, and all of that have been a common aspect of our, the evolution of fire-prone terrestrial landscapes. So we've the plants and vegetation in a given terrain has adapted in ways that are commensurate with fire in the habitat. And one of the fragilities comes about when we have human intervention. Maybe it's suppression, maybe it's development of the wildland-urban interface, maybe it's diseases that come out in plants that come, exotic diseases, bark beetle infestation, climate change, things like that, can introduce new fragilities. Okay, so what about the adaptive immune system? Well, the immune system, we sort of started looking at this saying, this may be interesting candidate because in the body, the immune system is something that adapts on the real time of the organism. So you can look at these trade-offs associated with adaptation, past infections, and so on, kind of in real time and see the development of structured complexity which reflects aspects of the environment. So the simple idea is that basically the immune system has some constraints on its resources, number of cells, say it allocates its resources in ways that will be efficient at fighting common diseases. So like she was saying with the flu, you don't get sick as much if you're re-exposed a second time to the disease. Maybe that's true here, maybe not so true for the fungus and the frogs, but in any case, this is a natural evolution of the adaptive immune system, and so it's a natural candidate for studying this mechanism. Okay, so I've got three sort of topics that I'm hopefully going to get to all of them, but I'm going to try to give you just a picture of how they fit into this framework first, so in case I go a little long, I can stop naturally at any of these places. The idea is we've developed a multi-scale model for immune system behavior based on the mechanics of individual cell types. So for me, I'm looking at population dynamics models too, but these are the populations of blood, white blood cells, lymphocytes in the body that are responding to diseases. And it's also the population of antigens that come into the body and cause infections. And the idea is to use these models to understand how the immune system solves problems, predict failures that will result from these problem-solving mechanisms, and understand, therefore, the robustness features of these mechanisms and also the trade-offs, the fragilities that go along with these natural mechanisms for adaptation. Okay, so the first thing that I'm going to talk about is how the immune system develops memory to past exposures. Okay, so this is really the adaptive part. When you get sick, you have memory cells, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And so that mostly is a protective mechanism. It creates immunity the next time the disease comes around. But if you run this for long periods of time and you have a constraint acting on your system, you develop an overspecialization or a fragility to rare diseases, things you haven't seen before. And there's, of course, also a sort of parallel arms race going on the other side of the diseases adapting themselves, which we haven't looked at yet, but is a really interesting next step for this. Okay, so this study will be the first one I talk about, and it's really looking at very long timescales. It leads to a phenomenon called immunosenescence, which is this extreme fragility of the immune system with age. The second study I'm going to talk about is one that looks at two exposures, sort of basically a primary exposure and a secondary exposure. And here I'm going to ignore cross-reactivity. Cross-reactivity is really talking about if I get exposed to something, it gets exposed to the same thing, I've got immunity, it gets exposed to something similar, I've got some protection. So that's talking about diseases that may give a beneficial effect, cowpox, smallpox, different things have cross-reactive protection, but in some cases they can create a fragility. Turns out that this simple model that I'll start with won't provide that fragility, so I have to also talk about what's called negative selection. Negative selection is the mechanism in your body that prevents most of the time autoimmune disease. So it's the thing that basically prevents letting you have a lot of lymphocytes that come and attack your organs most of the time. And when diseases participate in negative selection, it can create a vulnerability here through the cross-reactive effect. Finally, the last thing I'm going to talk about is something that has to do with the rate of infection. So There's a phenomenon which has been referred to as the hygiene hypothesis, which is studied in mouse models in laboratories. And the idea here is that if you are raised in a sterile environment, does that make you more susceptible to certain kinds of disease? And the hygiene hypothesis is saying, well, actually, there's a higher incidence of autoimmune disorders, allergies for animals raised in sterile environments. And so we're going to look at how the basic pathogenic influx, the rate of sort of exposure to diseases plays off against antigenic stimulation rate, which is really the growth rate of cells involved in autoimmune disorders, and how that provides a kind of a diagram with a sort of a crossover between rates of exposure that will suppress autoimmune disease and rates which will allow proliferation. Anyway, those are the three things. And now let me back up again and talk about the model. So this model we're going to start with is going to be, a population dynamics model for cells that are involved in the immune response. The antigen will be the infecting cell that comes in. And then there are different kinds of white blood cells. One is the naive cell. These are produced by the bone marrow, and you have this sort of constant flux of naive cells that replenishes on a fairly short time scale. And then memory cells are those cells that remain after infections. They have similar roles in the body, white blood cells, but the memory cells are long-lived, and they provide immunity the next time around. There are cells called dendritic cells, which play an important role in capturing the antigen and presenting it to the white blood cells that are going to clear it from the body. And then there's these effector cells. Effector cells are produced either by naive cells or memory cells in that infection process. So a naive cell that is presented with the antigen will split into effector cells and memory cells as well. Okay, so here are those reactions. There's a population dynamics which leads to growth of antigen. So this is just the cell splitting, some division rate. The capture of the antigen by these dendritic cells, which are going to present it later on to either the naive cells or the memory cells. So that's this lymphocyte stimulation. When the antigen is presented to one of these cells, it causes the division of that into the effector cell that's going to remove the antigen and also these memory cells that happen with different rate. There's the actual antigen removal, and then the effector cells die by apoptosis. Okay, so one of the things that's important is to come up with a kind of language for talking about different diseases. And so for that, we're borrowing a model which was introduced by Oster and Perlson, which is a shape space model. And the idea is here, what's going to really determine whether a white blood cell lymphocyte is effective for a particular antigen? A lot of features. It's shape, charge, size, hydrophobicity, are all contribute to the kind of lock and key response that leads to that binding. And we don't want to put all this detail into this first population dynamics model. Instead, what we're going to do is use a kind of abstract representation of how the models or how the lymphocytes and the antigens interact. And so this idea of shape space is basically to just use a kind of here in this case, two-dimensional space and a metric which we'll just take here based on the distance between the binding cell, the memory cell or the naive cell, and the antigen. How well they bind will be represented by distance on the space. So all these cells in the model, except for the dendritic cells, which don't have any antigen specificity, will live at some point on the shape space. And so here I'm representing X as the position that this cell, the effector cell, or sorry, the memory cell lives on. The antigen is Y, and the binding affinity between the two is just a Gaussian function of the distance between the two. And there's high affinity cells that bind well, here represented by the little circle and the ball that match really well. Low affinity will be further separated in shape space, represented by the circle and the triangle, which don't fit together so well. So maybe they can, there's some sort of continuous measure of distance in this space, which we'll use in terms of talking about a much more complicated process that you could zoom in on, which is going to involve all of these variables. Okay, so in any case, this population dynamics, everything I've told you so far, has a set of partial differential equations that live on this space, shape space, that describes the dynamical behavior. So I grow antigen at some rate, it's removed by effector cells, and it's also captured by these dendritic cells that are going to present it. The dendritic cells will capture the antigen when they have it. They don't have room to carry another one. The naive cells will be stimulated and divide. I guess here I've got the memory cells and so on. And again, the effector cells remove the antigen and die at some point. So the memory cells have a long life compared to the naive cells. Okay. So here I'm going to show you just exactly how this population evolves. If I have two infections, I'm just going to take, for now, two identical infections. So the idea is I'm going to inoculate my system with a certain amount of antigen and then track the sizes of all the different populations. So here's the first infection. Here's the second infection. Again, I'm not yet putting in the issues associated with different shape space yet. That comes later. Okay, so I get inoculated. I have my antigen grow. And then it's cleared from the system. I get inoculated a second time here. When it's growing, that will cause the important thing here is the D now is both the memory and the naive cells, which are creating more memory cells and also generating these effector cells, which clear the infection. So I see a ramp up of the effector cells. And in fact, it peaks after the infection has peaked, which is maybe why your symptoms are so high, for a particular cold or a virus, after your most contagious stage has passed. So there's this ramp up of the effector cells, die away, but they've left behind memory cells, which are these red ones. And now the second time around with the infection, you already have a lot of memory cells in place, so the ramp up of effector cells is more rapid, and the overall size of the basically the antigen growth and the duration of the infection is not as long. So this shows you that you have some immunity left over after the first occurrence of the disease. And what we use is this measure of the area under this curve to represent loss, just a measure of how severe the disease was. And that'll be something that we use in this model. Okay, so what happens if I have, you know, to my shape space picture after I have an infection? This is just showing one infection. And the idea is before I have an infection, I just have kind of a random population of these naive cells. And this graph below says what would be the loss were I infected with an antigen at any one of these positions. And then after I've had that infection located right here, you see that what the loss would be the next time around has changed a lot, and the severity in the neighborhood of that first infection has gone way down. Okay, so this is basically, it's gone way down. The other thing, though, that happens is you have more severity peaking up at other places. So that's the constraint, basically, that acts on the system in terms of the number of cells. Okay, so one infection, you know, sort of small effect. What happens if you go through a sequence of hundreds of infections? So now what I'm doing is looking at much longer time scales, adaptation of the organism, say, over a lifetime. And so this is a longer running simulation of that population dynamics. And the loss, basically the top graph is the loss experienced during the realization of the simulation. J here is an average loss, which represents the average over an ensemble of individuals with this behavior. And this sigma here is just the variability, the fluctuations that you measure. So there's basically three points along this sequence of infections that I'll show you here. The first is the beginning. This is like the child or the baby. And they just have a basically, you know, naive cell repertoire, no bias towards one disease or another. However, there's the sort of population of possible diseases, I've chosen 36 different infections. Some are more common, some are more rare. And I'm not going to pay any attention or worry about cross-reactivity at this point. I'll assume they're isolated. And you can see from these dots here, you can see where they are, right? Because once I get one of those infections, I develop memory in the neighborhood of that infection. And so that's why these circles are starting to pop up, because those are the positions of the infections in the model. Okay, so here would be a very likely one. Here would be a very rare one, for example. Okay, so I'm going along, and as I go along and have more and more infections, what I find is that the average loss is going down. I'm getting stronger in my immune system because I'm more able to handle, you know, these diseases that are most common. So the average loss is going down, and it's creating a more optimized or tuned immune system for the environment of infections that I may see. However, as I keep going, keep going, keep going, you see there pops up at the end, right? I have some huge losses, average losses coming in at the end, and that comes about because I've developed these holes in the immune system repertoire. And eventually, I see those diseases, and that causes these large losses at the end. Okay, so what does that look like statistically? So here I'm showing basically a statistics of loss sizes on the immune system. At the early stage, there's a very sort of uniform loss. All the diseases would have the same loss because nothing is preferentially set up in terms of the immune response. At this optimal, the minimum loss point along the curve, I have a distribution that's developed a slope here. So I have good response, pretty uniform response to events with small size, but I have a few larger losses possible in regions where I've begun to deplete things. That's actually better on average. That trait, having skewed my immune system, has given me a smaller average loss in the intermediate time scale. When you run the simulation all the way out to the end, you find that you've developed a very heavy-tailed distribution where you've left yourself some holes. And this is the signature of over-adapting to the resources for the common the common diseases at the expense of those rare events. And this is something that's observed. It's called immunosenescence, a tendency to overadapt with age, which leaves very little resources for new diseases. So this is the kind of thing that's seen with SARS and things like that, certain kinds of diseases that affect the aging population more. So this is just, again, a natural consequence of adaptation in the immune system. And these heavy-tailed distributions are a key signature of complexity, this type of thing seen not only in the immune system, but in a very broad class of complex systems. And so I just want to mention the fact that this sort of constrained resource optimization problem, where you have an uncertain set of initiating events, infections in the model, sparks for wildfires, resources which may suppress the loss, so immune repertoire in the model, things like fire breaks and other kinds of resources for fires. And you want to optimize these limited resources to minimize loss across a range of events. So we've looked at lots of different sorts of applications of this. These are some really early ones, the fires I'll focus on. The shape space model for the immune system, it's not like a fire break so much as it's like a sprinkler system. If you get something here, you know, where your sprinklers are located densely is more likely to fight it than putting a line around it. But it's very much the same kind of thing. And these power laws or heavy-tailed distributions, here a log-log plot, straight line is a signature of high variability phenomena. And the idea is most events are small, but most of the losses arise in the few largest events, and that's what we're also seeing in this immunosenescence. The idea of high variability is generally more important than power laws. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It can be an optimal thing. One of the things that happens in this immune system example, though, is that you go beyond what is optimal because you're only seeing what you see in your lifetime, and that will tend to lead to just blank spots having to do with your lack of experience. And so that goes beyond an optimal solution. Okay, so I've used a lot of time on that, but I wanted to get the basic idea across. Let me mention a little bit about cross-reactivity. The first model, we talked about this business of immunosenescence, really looked at a long time scale. Now what I want to do is focus on two sequential infections. It doesn't have to be sequential, just a primary and a secondary infection. Basically, we so often will use certain kinds of diseases that are asymptomatic or cause few symptoms in humans to inoculate against other kinds of diseases. And in fact, this is how the smallpox vaccine was discovered, was through exposure, basically was through immunity of people who have been exposed to cowpox. More generally, if you have had a previous infection, it can lead to immunity to the next infection. It could give you some cross-reactive protection, and it could have no effect if these two infections have very little to do with each other. And in rare cases, it can lead to vulnerability. And so this graph is basically saying I have a first infection in the middle of my shape space, and I'm looking at what the loss would be as a function of how far away the second infection is in shape space. And what you see is you see the loss goes from being very small, if I have exactly the same infection again, to something that sort of blends in with no bias at all when I go far away. So what this does is it basically isn't going to give me any vulnerability. It'll just give me a decay to what I would have had if I hadn't been infected before. So this model that we've talked about so far will give some cross-reactive protection, but no vulnerability. However, there are lots of examples where vulnerability is a real thing, and one of them is called the dengue virus. There are four related serotypes, so four related dengue viruses. If you get infected with one, then you have long-lived immunity to that and short-lived immunity to the others. If you get a second one, a different one, you'll find, again, short-lived immunity decays to something that could be really horrible called dengue hemorrhagic fever. And it's more common in children, and it also turns out it interacts with these dendritic cells. And so the question is, what mechanism produces this much more severe disease? And so this mechanism which we introduced called pathogen-induced tolerance is exactly that. And the idea is these dendritic cells, they're important for the pre-sorting of the immune system cells pre-naive cells, when they come out of the bone marrow or in the thymus, they prevent you from having a lot of autoimmune disease. So they basically are presenting, let's see, I think this is better, let's see. They prevent autoreactivity, oops. But if some of the cells from this dengue virus participate in that pre-selection, you can be left with a vulnerability. So if my dendritic cell is infected with one of the dengue serotypes, it will leave a hole in my immune repertoire so that when I'm infected, after my naive cells have recirculated, I'm left with a hole and this much more severe reaction. So I just would mention that this mechanism, which I'm rushing through, turns out it captures all of these different features of the dengue virus, and so it's unusual or unique, basically, in capturing all of this. Okay, so she's telling me that I'm done. So I won't have time to talk about the hygiene hypothesis, which is this business of basically looking more carefully at the homeostatic constraints and the rates of infection and trying to understand what the implications of that are in terms of autoimmune disease and allergies and memory loss of immunity and all kinds of things like that. But it's also a really, really interesting project. And I'll just skip to the end and talk to people later if they're interested. I'm hoping to convince you the immune system is a complex system, adaptation on time scales that are observable. There are many trade-offs in the immune system giving rise to vulnerabilities. And, you know, hopefully these can lead to, first, a basic global understanding of some of the physiological constraints aside from the molecular things. One of the things that's exciting to me is that there's more detailed modeling and understanding of individuals that seem to be coming out, that right now a lot of our quantitative results, you know, come from growth rates that can be measured in animal models or in petri dishes, and the idea that individually we can look at decay of, you know, immunity, immune cell numbers in vaccinations would be a really exciting future direction for this. Okay, I'm done.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.